This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. If you based your opinion on TV shows, you'd probably think that torture is very effective in getting people to talk. That's what my guest David Danzig is worried about. He's with the group Human Rights First, where he directs the Primetime Torture Project. The group is about to give an award to a TV show that depicts torture or interrogation in a realistic fashion. Also with us is Adam Fierro, who wrote an episode of The Shield, which is nominated for the award. He's a producer of the show. He briefly wrote for 24, although he says there were no torture scenes in the episodes he worked on. Colonel retired Stuart Harrington is with us too. He's a veteran interrogator who led a classified review of interrogation practices in Guantanamo Bay and Iraq, and now teaches interrogation techniques for the Army. He participated in a meeting Danzig arranged last year between veteran interrogators and the creative team behind 24 about realistic portrayals of torture. The Human Rights First Award for Excellence in Television will be given October 15th. Welcome, all of you, to Fresh Air. David Danzig, let's start with you. What's the purpose of this new award?
Well, since 9/11, we've really seen a change in the way in which torture is portrayed on television. It used to be that it was always the bad guys who used abusive techniques on television shows. And we're talking about, you know, the Nazis or the North Koreans. And when they used these kinds of techniques, they never worked. But since 9/11, we've seen a real shift in the way that these sorts of scenes are portrayed. We now frequently on television have heroes, people like Jack Bauer on the show 24, who use abusive techniques. And when these guys use abusive techniques, they invariably they work. Jack Bauer leans in on a subject and bim, bam, bang, he gets the information that he wants. And the problem with this is that it creates a misimpression in viewers in general and young people in particular who are considering a career in the armed services that these sorts of techniques might work. And we said to ourselves, wait a minute, TV's a huge influencer. Is there anybody who's really depicting it in a nuanced, realistic fashion that leaves an impression in the minds of viewers that this stuff doesn't work in the real world, that kind of mimics what the way in which it actually works? We started to look for that, and that's how we came up with this idea of this award.
Give us one or two examples of the shows that are nominated and why they're nominated.
A good example might be the show The Closer, which features a deputy police chief, and she's a tough interrogator. She gets answers. Almost every episode features a difficult interrogation in which she really presses subjects. But what's unusual about her is she does not use abusive techniques. She's not like Jack Bauer in that she's going to jam a knife in someone's knee in order to get answers.
Now, let me tell you, I was really surprised to find that an episode of The Shield was nominated for an award because this is, I mean, I love the show, but this is like an episode where Vic Mackey, like the lead cop on the show, tortures somebody to death who he suspects, he's pretty sure, killed one of his partners. And he's wrong, but he doesn't know he's wrong. So, Adam Fierro, you wrote that episode. Are you as surprised as I am that it's getting a Human Rights Award?
I was stunned. Well, we're nominated.
Nominated, yes, yes.
You don't normally think of Vic Mackey as an advocate for human rights in any way, and he certainly is not. In this case, there was a torture sequence that was very brutal and wound up being, I think, something that expressed a point of view that Human Rights First was interested in. In this particular case, Vic is torturing the wrong man, as you said, and he's trying to extract information. He's beating someone to death with a chain who's hung up in a remote building, and it's particularly vicious. And the person who is not the man that Vic is looking for winds up giving him the wrong lead. He tells him a lie. He says, this person is the one you're looking for, and then it sends Vic off to pursue that person. And that's one of the flaws in terms of that type of torture, and one of the reasons why, and I think the colonel can speak to this much better than I can, but suspects, the people who are being tortured will lie to stop the abuse. And in this case, this is what happened to Vic, and that's what we illustrated in the show in that particular scene.
Let's listen to the final scene in the torture sequence from this episode of The Shield. And just to set it up for our listeners a little bit, Vic Mackey, played by Michael Chiklis, you know, he's the head of a police strike force that cracks down on gangs and drug dealers. This scene shows Mackey at his most brutal and unlawful. And, you know, as we just heard, he's torturing the wrong man. He doesn't realize he's the wrong man. And he's you know, the scene starts with him putting a hood on the guy, and then he ties him up by his hands and has him hanging. And then he takes a chain and beats him. And the man who's actually responsible for killing Vic's partner is one of his fellow cops. And that cop, Shane, is in this scene too, and he's the one who keeps telling Vic to stop.
Hey! Hey! Just tell me what I want to know and this will be over. The boss was involved.
Come on, man. He's not talking.
He will. He'll talk. Who was it? Did a black cop get in touch with you? Kavanaugh. David Acevedo. It was Moya, wasn't it? It was that Salvadoran slut tipped you off. I know it.
You know what? Maybe he didn't do it, man.
If it wasn't Guido, who else was?
Look at him, man. I mean, if he had a name, don't you think he would have told us by now?
That just means he was acting alone.
Oh, come on, this is crazy, man.
He killed her! Don't you remember his body, his face? You think you could just forget that? Huh? Don't you think he deserves to die for what he did?
Look, I'm asking you not to do this for me.
Why not?
And after that, Vic Mackey shoots the guy. That's a scene from an episode of The Shield that was written by one of my three guests, Adam Fierro, and it's nominated for an award. It's a Human Rights First Award for a TV show that depicts torture and or interrogation in a nuanced, realistic fashion. And David Danzig is the person who came up with the idea for these awards and is administrating them. Why is this episode nominated?
To be honest, when we started looking at this clip, some of my colleagues thought I was insane for thinking, oh, this might be actually what we really want. But the reason that it's so good, I think, is that it isn't stylized torture. This is what it probably is like. And on top of that, what happens here is so different from what you see on other television shows like 24. When the torture starts, the victim gives up false information instead of immediately giving up the truth. What you frequently see on other shows is that when torture is employed, 5 seconds after it starts, a person who is willing to die for his cause gives up information and the plot moves forward. In this case, it leads to all sorts of problems for Mackey and others, and I think that's very realistic and important.
Colonel Harrington, let me bring you into the conversation. I feel like we're living in a very odd time in our country when it comes to torture. On the one hand, the country is so outraged about the abuses we saw at Abu Ghraib, and at the same time, there's a lot of torture scenes in our entertainment. What do you make of that?
Well, I agree with David that there really was a watershed event here with 9-1-1. And frankly, prior to 9-1-1, you know, professional interrogators, if you would have said, you know, the way to get information is to torture and to apply force and waterboard, we would have mocked that and said it was unthinkable. We traditionally, whether it was in the Vietnam War, the Gulf War, the invasion of Panama, when we interrogated, we depended upon our guile and our wits, knowledge of human psychology, knowledge of the source himself, his language, his culture, the movement that he's a member of, and put all this information together with a heavy dose of patience and stealth to essentially outwit the person and obtain the information that you wanted. So the notion that we'd even be having this debate, if you would have proposed it to me 5 years ago, I would have said that's unthinkable.
We're talking about torture, interrogation, and how TV depicts them. My guest, David Danzig of Human Rights First, directs the Primetime Torture Project, which is about to give an award to a TV show that depicts torture or interrogation in a realistic way. Also with us is Adam Fierro, who wrote an episode of The Shield, which is nominated for the award, and Colonel Stuart Harrington, a veteran interrogator who led a classified review of interrogation practices in Guantanamo Bay and Iraq. Colonel Harrington, what are some of the myths about the effectiveness of torture?
Principally, apart from the myth that it's an effective way to get information, the torture ethos, if you want to call it that, also shows things that are just manifestly untrue, such as that information could be obtained quickly through interrogation, when in fact most interrogators who are indeed experienced and professional know that interrogating a subject is a developmental process that takes time. And the idea that information is like a water tap that you can turn it on by, you know, a brutal stroke against the detainee, that's a big myth. And unfortunately, that myth pervades the people who want information. And so you find, for example, one of the things we learned in Iraq was that the chain of command had this thirst for information and thought that they could just tell the interrogators, you know, take the gloves off. We need this information. We need it now. And young interrogators, themselves not uninfluenced by pop culture, embraced this, when in fact, of course, genuine professionals understand interrogation is a human intelligence developmental thing that takes time, stealth, guile, patience, and has its limitations.
Well, Colonel, you told me that one thing that I was stunned is that the servicemen and women are actually able, they're watching 24 season DVDs, and that was part of the concern about where they're like literally directly drawing their information from a Jack Bauer torture scene and then applying that in the field. Is that accurate?
Yes. In fact, when I taught Army interrogators here last year in an organization that's been created to train interrogators and field interrogators who don't fall into the traps that interrogators have fallen into in Afghanistan and Iraq, I kept getting the question from the folks in the auditorium, well, you know, this tender, loving care approach, Colonel Harrington, that you propose, it all sounds well and good, but what happens when you have a prisoner whom you think knows this information and the clock is ticking and the chain of command has this insatiable desire for the information by sundown? And they were relating to me the ticking time bomb scenario that so pervades popular fiction, which I must tell you, in interrogations in three wars of hundreds of people, I never encountered such a scenario. So it's the perfect hypothetical out of which one creates drama. But in the real world, I never saw it. And I asked the sergeant major of the unit, where are they getting this idea that, you know, the chain of command wants the information tomorrow or tonight, and, you know, the person might have the keys to saving, you know, thousands and thousands of lives? And the answer was, they get it from television. They get it from the shows that are on TV. And, of course, 24 is the premier show that features that tactic.
You know, I hear what you're saying, of course. But on the other hand, I can't help but wonder, why would somebody give up information unless they're going to pay serious consequences if they don't?
There are many reasons why professional interrogators prevail or tend to prevail when they use smart developmental tactics. And the number of reasons and the number of methods is directly connected to the number of sources. That is to say, every source is a different, unique individual. For example, I have had people tell me things that only a few hours before they were refusing steadfastly to tell anyone because I realized that it was their birthday, they were miserable, and their wife didn't know if they were dead or alive. And by allowing the simple gesture of a phone call, the person did a volte face and became cooperative. That's one finite example. I could spin examples like that for hours.
Well, give me another one.
An individual who says that he has the key information that we need, that the information is in an attaché case at his home, and he'll give us the address if we'll go get it and get it to him. We do that. We bring it back, but when we open it in private, we find that the real reason why he asked us to go there was because the attaché case was full of letters from his mistress, and he didn't want his wife to get them. And so we helped him by getting it out of the apartment. And when we made it clear to him that we knew what that was all about and that we understood it, that it was a very human thing for him to do, he broke into tears because we'd saved his marriage. And from that point on, he was indebted. And even though it sounds pretty crass, there was another example of just a key that led to a change in the situation with respect to the person.
Would you have used those letters to blackmail him after that? Say, unless you give us the information, we're going to your wife with these letters?
No, that would be crude and stupid. In fact, that never needed to be said. He knew that we had the letters, and because he was the sort of fellow he was, not an admirable fellow, somewhat corrupt, he attributed to us in his mind the kinds of conduct that he himself might take if he were in our situation. We never had to say a word.
So did you get any information really worth getting from him?
Superlative. Everything having to do with the Noriega regime's secret contacts with the PLO, the North Koreans, the Libyans, the Cubans.
Now, you wrote a classified report on interrogation techniques in Iraq. This was before the Abu Ghraib story broke. What were some of the things you warned about in Iraq? Can you tell us, or is that still classified?
Actually, the report was a report that was written exclusively for the general officer who invited me to Iraq to take a look at detainee operations because she was concerned that they weren't in a good state of health. Mm-hmm. It subsequently leaked to the Washington Post intact, by means of which I have no knowledge. But I can state, since it's been a matter of public record now, that I certainly was aware that they had serious leadership problems and serious problems of how detainees were being taken care of in more than one facility. At Abu Ghraib, my team and I didn't see torture, not that one would expect that they would, you know, do this for us or show it to a visitor from the States. What we did see, however, was the perfect storm of, you know, inexperienced officers on both the intelligence and the MP side of the house, some very poor leadership, an insecure environment where these folks were being mortared, where they had so many detainees that they were frightened of a detainee uprising. They were overcrowded, and there were huge pressures by the chain of command for instant results. And that was sort of, if you will, the perfect storm of, you know, that led to the kinds of conduct that happened out there.
You've been to Guantanamo, too, haven't you?
Yes.
And what can you tell us about what you saw there that you thought crossed a line?
Generally speaking, what I saw at Guantanamo and in Iraq shared the same problem, and that is that the professional understands that to get information from people like this, that you have to handle yourself in a patient, developmental fashion, and that harsh conditions of captivity and harsh treatment and sometimes lapsing into overt brutality is counterproductive. And I didn't see at Guantanamo, nor did I see in Iraq, the kind of subtle, clever, well-thought-out interrogation operations of the sort that we had run in either Vietnam, Panama, or the first Desert Storm.
Would you give me a sense of what was different in those operations? Like, you say well-thought-out plans. Like, what can you give us a sense of what a well-thought-out plan looks like?
Well, in the first place, one-size-fits-all approach to every detainee, which those who recall the images of when they first set up Guantanamo know what I'm talking about. Everybody's in orange jumpsuits. Everybody's shackled. People are led around with an MP on each side of them. They're brought to an interrogation room, and their one foot is shackled to the floor, and two MPs sit there with arms folded while the interrogator comes in and begins to, you know, direct a barrage of questions against the detainee. That's a very unsophisticated, heavy-handed, and ineffective approach to interrogation. When I went to Guantanamo, that was the norm. Prisoners were all lethal killers. The interrogator would be in a room with them, but with guards, the person shackled down, the type of thing that communicates to the detainee that you're afraid of him, which a professional interrogator would never countenance. The notion of human interaction, the notion of treating this person one way because of his culture or because of the way he seems in your assessment of him compared to this person over here who might require a different suite of options and how he's treated. All those things are the way one does it. And one size fits all with orange jumpsuits, shackles, and hoods is as far away from that as you can get.
You know, you keep saying that professionals know better. than to use these kinds of, torture techniques. Are you implying that it's amateurs who really didn't know better who were responsible for putting these techniques into place?
I'll do better than imply it. I'll say it. Yes, I believe so. I believe that for whatever reason, a school of thought took place or took hold, that the way to get information was to take the gloves off, and that after 9-1-1, a series of orders went out to the field, which had to do with basically an approach that had they sought genuine professional advice from people who really understood and knew the interrogation business, they would have been counseled against it. But they were determined that they were going to get this information, that it was a save the United States type of a situation, and they went down the slippery slope in an approach to handling detainees, which has redounded terribly against our country.
Are you counting the former Secretary of Defense, Donald Rumsfeld, as one of the quote, amateurs when it comes to interrogation?
Happened on his watch.
We're talking about torture, interrogation, and how TV depicts them. I have three guests. Colonel Stuart Harrington is a veteran interrogator who led a classified review of interrogation practices in Guantanamo Bay and Iraq. Adam Fierro wrote an episode of The Shield that is nominated for a Human Rights First Award for Excellence in Television for depicting torture or interrogation in a realistic way. David Danzig directs Human Rights First's Primetime Torture Project and is overseeing the award. David, are you concerned about becoming the kind of pressure group that tries to impose its agenda on the media and risk becoming almost a form of censorship by going to TV shows and saying, we object to what you're doing, maybe it would be better to do it this way? And I know you're trying to come at it from a very enlightened way, but nevertheless, are you worried about possibly crossing a line into the kind of pressure group that you wouldn't want to be?
That's really a part of why we want to do this award, to show that, in fact, it is an opportunity for television and television writers and creators of television to show torture in a way that not only is really interesting, but also doesn't have this negative unintended consequence of leading people to believe that torture works. So our goals here is to kind of gently nudge people who work in Hollywood to think more deeply about torture and the way in which they portray it.
I guess this is something I'm curious about, and there's a question for you, Adam, as a TV writer. I know you've met with David Danzig from Human Rights First and with, Colonel Harrington, who is an expert in interrogation and teaches interrogation. Would you also sit down with other people who came knocking at the door who thought that violence didn't belong on TV, or that anything sexual didn't belong on TV, or that religion should be shown only in a certain light, in a positive light on TV? I mean, once you open the door, are you worried that it remains open to everybody who has their own agenda and wants to change the way you write your shows?
I don't think so. I think they're expressing a point of view. And listen, we are selling a product to an audience, and I think that we never lose sight of that. If an organization comes up and says, we don't like that, or please be aware of that, or please be cautious of that, I mean, it all goes into the mix, and we're all processing it, because we're writing shows that are intended to be viewed, and they're intended to be digested. I don't look at that as a negative. I think as long as we're not restricted, when it comes to the point where the network says, well, you can't do that, or you can't do that, or we don't want to do that, then it becomes limiting. But I'm all about hearing people's points of view. I mean, I think the more the better.
I want to thank you all for talking with us. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you.
David Danzig directs the Human Rights First Primetime Torture Project, which on October 15th will give an award to a TV show that depicts torture or interrogation in a realistic way. Adam Fierro wrote an episode of The Shield, which is nominated for the award. Colonel Stuart Harrington is a veteran interrogator who led a classified review of interrogation practices in Guantanamo Bay and Iraq. We recorded this interview last week before the New York Times broke the story that in 2005, the Justice Department issued secret opinions endorsing the use of harsh interrogation techniques. These techniques include waterboarding and head slapping. We wanted to get Colonel Harrington's reaction to the Times story. After reading the article, Colonel Harrington wrote us that he was not surprised by the news, Since the administration is under pressure to protect intelligence personnel who have been reassured that their methods since 9/11 were legal. But he was disappointed because this shows that even after the ugly revelations of misconduct by interrogators beginning in early 2004, the administration appears to remain bound by a misguided and ill-informed belief that brutal interrogation means are effective, in spite of overwhelming feedback from professional interrogators that they are not.